Yo, you chilling with Cool 187. You know, our brother Law's in the building. You know how we do it. And you know, right about now, I'm chilling with the Odd Man on Down with the Kings on Maximum FM Hip Hop Radio. Blah!
Turn up the bass!
You're listening to Down with the Kings on Maximum FM Hip Hop.
Back we are here on Down with the Kings. It's the Odd Man here on Maximum FM Hip Hop. We're going to take a pause in the music and turn to our featured guest. He's a West Coast legend and even dubbed the godfather of G-Funk, and we're proud to have him here. He is Cold 187, Big Hutch in the building. What's happening, my man?
Yo, chilling, man. You know, how you doing?
I appreciate you taking the time and chilling and hanging out with us. In my description, referred to you as a legend. In terms of what you've done in the hip hop industry, they're taking long to get used to that, because I'm sure you've heard that a lot. You've heard that a few times. The first time you heard that, were you comfortable with it?
Nah, I mean, I still feel kind of uncomfortable because I guess I'm still in the makings. You know what I mean? I'm still working every day. I'm still grinding. You know, it's kind of hard for you to consider. I don't consider myself being nothing but a guy that loves to do music, and fortunately, I'm able enough to give it to the world. You know, unlike a lot of other people. You know, that may a lot of my fallen soldiers, and you know, a lot of people that haven't had that opportunity. So I'm just blessed to be able to continue after these many years and to give you guys hot music. You know. So I don't consider that, but it's an honor. Thank you.
No doubt about that. Well, it's just interesting because, again, you know what, when you look at sort of the body of work, and I mean yours, there's no question your catalog is huge and what you've done and who you've been a part of. But you can't help but think. I mean, you think you've been exposed to sort of legendary artists who've made incredible music. It's just a phenomenal. Must have been a blessing for you when you think about it.
Absolutely, yeah. That's what I believe. Truly, it is. I mean, in order to be able to work with people from, you know, Eazy-E, N.W.A., you know, Tupac, Snoop Dogg, you know, E-40, Above the Law, you know, Cocaine. Oh man, the list goes on. You know, you dig. So yeah, it's definitely a blessing.
Do you pinch yourself every so often when you think about it, man?
Oh, absolutely, man. I never thought that, you know, I would have the opportunity to do what I do. I only studied music since I was really little, but I kind of done it, you know, following the, you know, the family legacy, the footsteps of my father and my uncle.
Right.
You know, but never thinking that I could break the ground that I've broken, you know, or even be in the same room with people like the people that I can name off of my discography. So it's unbelievable. It's like a dream. Yeah.
Right. Well, it was interesting when you talked about sort of following in your footsteps as your father and your uncle. I mean, you know, they were sort of your father's Motown artist. This is still very different, if you will. I mean, we're talking about the hip hop game, and you know, quite frankly, in the early origins of West Coast / gangster rap. I mean, you were part of that.
Right. Yeah, and the funny thing about that is, you know, I grew up being a musician. You know, I played several different instruments. I played piano, bass guitar, and I played trumpet. And when hip-hop broke on the scene in the mid-late 80s, for me, it was kind of like another way that I could express myself as a musician and a writer. You know, fortunately, what I was able to do is with, you know, being a person who had the musical background, I was able to get into production. You know, and then at first, I think my father, you know, which he was Richard Hutch, which was a writer and producer at Motown, and then my uncle's Willie Hutch. At first, they were more like, "What are you doing? Like, you know, you studied all this life, and you have this vast history of great music and all this, and now you want to do rap, especially gangster rap, you know?" On top of that, was even crazier. But I think once they got an ideal of understanding that that's where music was going, and I have to, you know, I have to create my own mark in order to live the legacy, you know, of the family and everything. I have to make my own mark. They really backed me up.
Gotcha. Well, and I can see very much where, you know, again, they're scratching their head because, you know, this is an entirely, you know, different lane, and so I totally get that. The part. That I think is really impressive, quite frankly, is the fact that you had the sort of foresight to see where it was going and how, you know, you could take your past experiences and what you've done and, you know, from a musical standpoint and apply it to this new arena.
Yeah, and I think what a lot of people have to understand when you come from the aspect of where I came from, it is more about the creative point of it. And the new part of it is where you're going to make your mark. It's not really following suit. I think being innovative and coming from a family that was very, you know, they come from a different form of music, far as like blues and rock and roll, and then into soul and funk and all of that. I learned how to be my own man coming into the game. So I kind of gravitated to hip hop because it was different because of the fact of my background. You know, I think if I would have came from a family that followed suit or just was more traditional, I wouldn't have been able to make my mark like that, you know, or even venture into it. I think I wouldn't have been as fearless as I was.
Well, and really, when you look at that time, I think in the early stages of the music, because there was no blueprint, so to speak, you know, it was kind of almost like a free for all and try your own thing and see how that works out. And it kind of sounds like it worked for you in that regard.
Yeah, so is music. I mean, you know, I think that is the blueprint of being a true person that really does his own music. I think he has to experiment, and I think he has to experiment with what he feels is the going thing. You know, I came up even when you look at hip hop in the early days, it was really diverse. I mean, it went from Run DMC to Public Enemy to, you know, to the Beastie Boys, you know, on to NWA and Eazy-E, you know. So my blueprint of hip hop was very, very different. I mean, you had rare guys like Eric B and Rakim, which Rakim was one of the most rarest guys, you know, on the mic. Then you had a MC like KRS-One. Who, you know, then you had a cat like Eazy-E, you know. So I think that was the beauty of my era, you know. When you flip back, you know, you have a lyrical maniac like a Big Daddy Kane or sort. And those are the type of MCs I was brought up on, and that's the kind of fusions of music with the production of, you know, a Bomb Squad or Howie T different type of music that was coming out in that era made it be able for me to create a blueprint like an Above the Law and come with a different thing. Then, you know, then Entree working with Dr. Dre made it even, you know, that much more stronger as a producer.
Gotcha. Now I got it loud and clear. Let's talk about the early days of Above the Law and actually getting signed to Ruthless, because I know from what I know about in terms of the history, if you will, you know, Above the Law very much still was you know, sort of, you know, in the streets doing their thing, so to speak, and not necessarily out there trying to be musical artists, if you will. Sort of talk about those early days, because I think it's interesting for people.
Well, we came up, young teenagers, you know, I mean, you know, in the streets hustling real heavy. I mean, our first demo was made off of Hustle Money, you know, to say. It was a collective few of us came together and, you know, instead of taking our money and, you know, buying more jewelry and more cars, we decided to create Above the Law with it. You know, me being at the helm of music and, you know, KMG and DJ Chaos, you know, helping co-produce and write. You know, we had something when we were, you know, teenagers, and we felt like, you know, it could deliver us from the streets. So we decided to do that ourselves, and, you know, we done the demo Living Like Hustlers, and from there we submitted it to a good friend of ours, which then turned it over to Laylaw from NWA, and then he got it to Dr. Dre and Eazy-E. And that's the birth of us. The street money turned into legal money, turned into what you guys have today as legendary, is known, as you said, at the top of the show, Above the Law. You know?
Gotcha. I like that you call it Hustle Money. That's a politically correct term. I like that.
Yeah, man. It's the 80s, so, you know, it was a very, very lucrative time, but a very, very critical time for a teenager, you know, coming up in L.A. County, or the city of Los Angeles as well. You know, it's a very, very crazy time. The 80s, the mid-late 80s was very, very crazy for us. You know, so for us to be delivered from that through music is definitely a blessing. It was a blessing.
Now, when you turned to music, did you basically drop everything cold turkey kind of thing, or were you sort of, you know, halfway in, halfway out? Or did you?
Well, yeah, because, you know, you have friends, you have childhood friends that they're still in the streets, so you're still kind of connected to that. You know, so, you know, I don't think you ever let the streets go when you've truly been in the streets. I mean, you know, we weren't studio gangsters, you know, no disrespect for people who look on the outside looking in, you know,
right.
they just know how to interpret it, you know, from the outside, but we're from the inside. So, you know, that was our life. Everything we portrayed on Living Like Hustles was basically a normal Friday night for us or a Saturday afternoon. So, yeah, I mean, that was very, very hard to transition like that. But the great thing about it is that, you know, first of all, you know, we wanted to get out of the streets, you know.
Right.
But when you're young, you know, bad habits hard to break, you dig?
Of course, I got you.
And friends are hard to shake. So.
Right. I got it. I got loud.
Yeah, peer pressure was still a big part of it, you know. But I think another thing was more so when you're in it and you're not the outside looking in and you're involved in it, it's kind of hard for you to just shake that off.
Right.
Overnight, as you say, like overnight. It was a gradual thing. You know, leaving the streets totally alone was a gradual thing.
Well, I mean, another part of this I think is important, and you touched on the fact that, you know, what you were you're portraying in your music was your real life. And again, to suddenly become, you know, turn from one thing and become entirely different, that's not an easy transition to make. So I get it. Loud and clear.
No, it's not. No. And you gain, when you're in the streets, you gain a lot of, you know, in the streets is about being loyal. You understand?
Right.
And that's what's hard to break, like to live a totally different life when you have so much vested time into it. You know, it's hard to just switch it off like a light switch.
Gotcha. Do you remember the first time you met Eazy-E? What was that like, that experience?
Oh, the first time we met Eazy was we came to Audio Achievement, and there was this lobby in Audio Achievement with this boombox. You know, back then, you know, people listened to the boomboxes. But the boombox was a reference to what was being mixed in the studio. So they would mix songs down to a cassette, you know, take it out in the boombox and see how it would sound, you know, in the boombox. So when we first came in, you know, it was all of us collective as Brother Law. You know, at this time, I think we had added, Go Mac with the sack into the group. And we all came down to have a meeting, and we listened to Murder Rap, Untouchables was on that demo. And, you know, all I can remember is them all coming out, him and Dre coming out to the lobby and dropping it in their boombox, and us just all huddled around a boombox, you know, just listening to the demo. And from there, you know, we never left Ruthless Records. And that was like
home.
The summer of, I want to say that was right before they had, I want to say that's right before they went out back out, the last leg of the Easy Does It tour, or what people see in a movie called Straight Outta Compton tour.
Yeah.
That was the last leg of that. And from there, I guess you could say we was joining at the hip.
What was that like being on the road with that whole, during that time? I mean, the group was at its height, its pinnacle, so to speak. You know, they got a lot of attention. Law enforcement wasn't a big fan of the group, but the fan base loved them. What was that like watching this, all this for you?
Oh man, it's incredible. I mean, the reason why I got the skills that I have, you know, on, and the chops that I do have is studying NWA's performances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, I know how to go out and rock a show is because of them. You know, I can't. To me, like people look at it, and people be, you know, certain groups might say, yeah, well, you know, they're like the this group or that era, this group, that era. To me, they're like my Beatles. You know what I mean?
You.
I got the whole blueprint of, like, a lot of people got the rock and roll blueprint from the Beatles. You know, like, to me, in hip-hop, they're my Beatles. And they were, as above the law, our whole blueprint in how to do it, you know, on every level. You know, how to be showmen, how to electrify and light up crowds, you know. How I have the chops that I have is because at Ruthless, one thing we had is we wanted to be better than everybody else, but we wanted to do what the fuck we wanted to do. You know what I'm saying? We didn't want to copy, you know, an R&B group or a band. We wanted to bring that same energy as a rock and roll band, but in hip-hop, you know, And you know, when I was growing up, I seen a lot of groups. I seen Eric B. and Rakim live. I seen Run DMC live.
Mm-hmm.
I had went to Crush Groove before and all of that. You know, all those big hip hop festivals in the 80s.
Yep.
But to live it and have people mentor you like Eazy-E, Dr. Dre, Laidlaw, all
yes.
these different people groom you, it was a
wow.
whole different level because that was I was being groomed at the height of their career.
Mm.
You know, wasn't
mm.
being groomed at the embryo. I knew them coming
yep.
up. You know,
mm-hmm.
but when it all blew up, they still were so solid and to have an opportunity to be involved in something and then people give their energy to you and say, this is how you do it. This is the
right.
level you do it on, you know,
right. Right.
and we expect
right.
nothing less. And that's just how Eric was. Eric was, I won't say he was a perfectionist, but he was a showman and he was about showing you, you know what I mean, how to be a showman. None of them ever were guys who didn't want to give themselves to you. Like, this is how you do it when you set up the crowd. I mean, even down to the chants, even down to the, you know, the way your show flows.
Mm.
We were taught all of that, man.
You know, and what's so impressive about Eric is, and when you talk about him as an artist, that wasn't what he went into the game to start off to be. I mean, you got to learn
no.
that stuff. And
exactly.
not only did he learn that, he perfected it and was able to pass it
exactly.
along, which is incredible.
Yeah, because I think with him, he loved music, you know,
mm-hmm.
and he was man enough to put people around him that knew it a little better than him, and that's why it became so successful, because he knew how it worked. You know, he knew, like, okay, your show has to be tight. The records
yep.
have to be solid. They have to be about you, and they have to be saying something in a certain way, you know. It has
gotcha.
To be a little bit funny. It has to be a little bit serious. It has to be a
mm-hmm.
little bit pain in it, you know.
Mm.
he
mm.
knew it. Not even,
yep.
not even. I guess the science on it and on a spiritual base to him was that he just understood that how it moved him, he was able to convey it, put it in, you know, put it in a music sense,
yep.
and give it back to people.
Gotcha.
You know?
Gotcha. Incredible. Incredible. You know, since we're talking about, you know, you said giving back to people, and I think this is a good opportunity for our listeners to hear a song that was on the very first single off Living Like Hustlers album back
yeah.
in 1990. Murder Rap is the
demo.
Song. Tour.
I got the deal.
That right. Let's do it. Let's throw it right now. You want to throw it up for us?
Let's get it, man. It's Above the Law. Murder Rap. Because a brother like me said, well, Above the Law.
They tryna give you a murder rap, and you ain't even like that. Yo, serve these niggas cause they deserve to get this.
When I sit down and write and recite for the mic at home, make sure my beats are loud and bold and cold. 187, that is my name, making it simple and plain. Can't you rearrange and change the things that I couldn't do in the past? Don't be surprised when you got a shot. Get up your ass, perpetrator. That one was just for you. I'm gonna leave the ENC for Mango without a clue. Style like a bean on coke, but if you say the wrong thing, I wash your mouth with soap. No, it's not the answer, no, I'm not a cancer, no, I'm not a hero of zero, but a Leo in stereo. And this is not a demo, chaos and go back, keep cutting the flex, tempo back. Fingerprints ain't nothing without the murder weapon. Keep stepping. Homicide tried to sweat, but we let him have it. You can see the fear through their teeth. Treat them like Rolaids and give them some relief.
I feel action. Speaks loud in the words and verbs and adjectives. I live the life to give and give. Not who's first, second, or third. Not he said or she said or what you heard, nerd. Cause when you live like that, your life is mango. In other words, your life is all tangled up. I'm not a sucker, always go for mine. Power law, I saw it from the start. And he will always achieve. Sometimes that's even higher than the others believe. I'm not a doctor, not a boy, and I don't have a degree. That arrogant, egotistical, but the epitome. Dictate, recline, keep suckers in line, transform to another world as I recite.
themselves as notorious. Brothers gotta learn hip hop anger ranges inside themselves. Yo, flee to another position, I contact Chaos and the homie G.
187 breaking back, backbone of my group. Basket in my posse and I'm getting loose. Cause I'm taking out process, causing bodily harm. Making moves to improve as I begin to brainstorm. I'm not inferior, not taking no crap. Last sucker try to diss me, call you got a snack slap. Cause power's my name, sometimes I'm insane. And if I get too mad, I have to rearrange. Your position as an MC, that's the way it should be. The way I get over, I use terminology. That's comprehensive, redemptive, that's evidently not related to the style that you hear every day. D-boy, destroying and torn and torn while the other suckers are depressed. I'm enjoying what I'm doing and ruin anyone's hope for my position. Tell them, KMG, they on a mission.
They're on a mission to keep wishing you can't come off. 187, you're menacing your own mind. So take heed and proceed with caution when you rhyme.
Down with the Kings, it's the Odd Man, and I'm joined by Big Hutch, a.k.a. Cold 187, in the building. We just heard Murder Rap. When you kind of hear about that, when you hear that song, and you reflect back to that time when you're, you know, developing, making it, what was sort of the mindset, or what were you really trying to attempt to get across when you made that track?
Well, I think what me and KMG was trying to do is we were just trying to say, like, when you're so deadly with what you're doing, people are going to label you as a killer, you know, even if you haven't caught you with anything. It's not what you know, it's what you can prove type of thing, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, even if you don't got the weapon, you're still going to label me a murderer because the way I carry myself lyrically.
Gotcha.
And for us, we always figure out a way to bring our reality to art. You know,
right.
Which is the cleverness of, like, a murder rap. It was more like I wanted to be, you know, DJ Chaos named me Cold 187 because I used to battle when I was young. And he was like, yeah, you know, you like killing them. You know, you killing them. I was like you know, like you murdering them. He said, you should name yourself 187. And then I was like, you mean like a murderer like that? And I said, well, why don't I be a cold murderer, like a cold killer? You know what I mean? On the mic. And that's how me and KMG came up with the song Murder Rap, because that's what, you know, they used to say, like, you're a cold killer on the mic. You know?
That's it. Yeah. Nice. Something, and I appreciate this story because I always love hearing the origins of how things came to be. So that's an awesome. I love it. Something that I actually just learned very recently that, you know, after you left Ruthless, you went to Death Row and you were an executive and oversaw some major projects over there. One of them being the Tupac's post-op
right.
album. That was pretty awesome.
Yeah, until the end of time, which was an honor, man, to do his. His mom actually asked me to do it, and I was vice president at Death Row at the time. And it's funny, the story to that is that, you know, they didn't really have a guy with a music ear that wanted to do that gig, you know. And the funny thing about it, Edie from the Outlaws was like, well, Hutch is there, and him and Pac are good friends. And and his mom was like, you know, said, well, let Hutch, you know, supervise the record. And it's cool because I end up producing like four songs on it and mixing a whole album and overseeing a whole project, you know, which was, I guess, to the date is one of his biggest records, you know, which is, that was a good dear friend of mine. So I'm definitely honored to do that. It was an honor, you know. That was one of the highlights of my life, you know,
working on
that record. Yeah.
Well, when I heard that, I was like, wow, that's huge, that's big, because that's not that's nothing small. You know what I'm saying? Hutch ain't nothing.
Oh no. and it was a great experience for me because I wanted to get more executive chops.
Yeah.
So I was able to work with different producers and writers and engineers and staff and put a record together.
Right.
So that was a wonderful experience that I had working on that project. And then, you know, a couple of other projects I worked with alongside Shug, you know, as well.
Gotcha, gotcha. You've been steady working nonstop, and you've front of the mic and behind it from a production standpoint. Mm-hmm. What do you prefer?
I prefer it all if it has anything to do with entertainment. I love it.
Gotcha.
So, I mean, the great thing that I've always experienced and the fortunate thing for me, I came in doing them both.
Right.
So, but my preference is to be on that stage.
Gotcha.
You know, because I was born performing, so they say, you know. So.
No, I hear you.
That's where I'm most comfortable at.
Mm-hmm.
Is on stage because it's nothing like the experience of it, you know, like the right now moment. It's the more out of body thing because we're recording. You always have time to analyze, look back, evaluate, fix. Live, you don't have that. It's the moment.
Gotcha.
Everything is the rush, the moment, the height, and that's what always keeps me wanting to do more music is getting it to the live aspect, getting it to you. So I think as I love the performance part, you know, although I think the more enriched part is the creative part, like taking an idea from nothing and turning it into Murder Rap or turning it into Black Superman or, you know, turning it into, you know, Neighborhood Sniper or whatever, you know. So, or listening to someone's vocals and saying, I think that's the most satisfying. But the part I do like the most is the performance.
Gotcha. Definitely benefits to both sides of them. I can hear that as you explain loud and clear. You know, one thing that is evident to me, and you sort of even talked about, you know, with Tupac's mother wanting to be a part of the project, it very much seems that, you know, having solid industry relationships have been a positive thing for you. Is that accurate to say?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, because I just think, like, you know, like the era I came from, it was a lot of negativity. The life I lived was a lot of negativity. So when I came into the industry, I tried to befriend people as much as I can. And if things didn't work, I knew how to sit down with people and say, hey, let me shake your hand and thank you for, you know, the ride that we had, but I'd just rather move on. And I've been able to keep relationships with everyone because of that, you know, being honest and being loyal and being down. And if things didn't work out, it may have not been because of our relationship, it may be because a better opportunity opened up or that situation ran its course and I done my part, you know. So I'm very thankful that I didn't have this crazy odds, you know, ins and outs with a lot of people in the industry.
Yep. No, and that certainly is important, and being able to, especially when you talk about the longevity and your legacy. I mean, you know, you certainly don't want to be that guy that people didn't like working with. And obviously, you know, you've done that, and we know
and
that
I've
there's
always
people
been,
out there that...
you know, coming from a creative, I always take these things. I don't really take this literal. I kind of take it from that it's about being creative. So I've always stayed open to what people want or what people want of me. You understand? Like, maybe if I came in with some expectation, like, oh, you should be giving me more, or you should be, you know, you know how sometimes we do that, you know?
Right.
But I think creatively, like, when no one wanted to deal with Shug asked me to come fill his shoes when he was incarcerated at Death Row to be the vice president, to work with the producers and the marketing and promotion guys and all the things, ins and outs and stuff, you know, that had everything to do with entertainment. Well, it was a very positive thing. It wasn't nothing negative about it. And I had nothing to do with what happened before, so I stayed out of it, you know.
Right.
And the same when Dre left and I stayed at Ruthless. I had nothing to do with him leaving, so I stayed with Eric and did the same thing at Ruthless, basically.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So I never, you know, I never worried about that because I always stuck to the business. I never got personal. I never got into people's personal indifferences. So.
No, absolutely. And that's the way to go. That's the way to go. You know, Hutch, one last question I want to ask you about in terms of the current state of gangster rap, so to speak, and I think it's an interesting one. I know earlier on you sort of touched about studio gangsters, and we know there's a whole lot of them out there. But do you still think, you know, gangster rap as you know it exists, or do you think it still has a place today?
Yeah, I do. I just think more things to me are commercialized. And I think that it's a fine line between what we used to do and what you call nowadays gangster rap. I think a guy, like for instance, I think a kid can come rapping out of the projects, and his perspective of what's going on in the projects may be a little bit different than our perspective, but it's the same issues.
Gotcha.
So I don't think – because I think that it was only called gangster rap because of the tone and the particular content, but it really was reality-based. So if you look at a person that's talking about their borough, their project, they hood, they block or whatever, to me that's the origin of gangster rap.
Gotcha.
I don't care who it is, if it's a J. Cole, a Kendrick Lamar, or, you know, whoever it may be. You know, if that's the origin of what they're talking about, then it still has the undertones of gangster rap. Will there ever be another N.W.A. Above the Law? I can't say, or even a Tupac. I can't really say. But
right.
I know that we have the same issues in 2015 that we had in 1989 on a global scale, and maybe even more. You know, maybe even worse. You know, because the drugs are worse, and you know, police brutalities at the same point of high. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So I do think I do think the content of being a reality-based rapper can exist in the modern day because there are still a lot of issues day to day. There's still no murder rate in the same cities are still the same. You know, the police, violence is the same.
Right.
You feel me? The poverty, the poverty level is the same. You know, so and that's all the things those were the template of our origin of making music. So, I think so. I would believe so. I mean, if someone is there, I think what is the hardest thing is that they figured out so many different ways to kind of cookie cut hip hop.
Right.
It's hard
right.
for people to pay attention to really true artists that want to make that true message and put it out there to the world.
That real message, no doubt.
Yeah, they figure out a way to cookie cut and sell the music and desensitize it so bad that when you come with a real topic, a real issue, you may get watered down in the process that artist.
And back then
they couldn't water us down because guess what? Like you spoke early on the interview, they didn't know what it was.
Right. It was
but
all
they
new.
Knew
yeah.
the kids wanted it. Now they can say we know what the radio wants to play. We know what we know that it's formulated now. So it's hard for you to really exist and say, hey, I'm a gangster rapper. You just have to be a person that has a certain agenda, a certain line you're trying to push, and do it in a way that you want to. And then by the grace of God, you become a hit rapper, and then you can say everything you wanted to say.
There you go. You know, Hutch, I gotta admit, I lied. I said last question, but I gotta ask you about Straight Outta Compton. If you checked out the movie, I'm assuming you did.
What you thought
about it? What'd you think about it?
I love the movie. You know, I loved it. I thought it was produced really great. For me, the best thing about Straight Outta Compton for me is that it showed you an era.
Right.
That needed to be shown, and going back to what me and you just talked about, it showed you why the music was being made. It showed you why we all had the temperament that we had to make the type of music that we made. And to me, that's the best thing. Now, it's a few things in it that I could say, okay, you could have focused on this a little more, but that's because I was there. But overall, I thought it was an incredible movie, and I thought it was a needed. I think if anyone deserved a movie, would be N.W.A.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And in terms of accuracy, because that's always often a question mark where people say, well, mm-hmm. it wasn't just like that, and it was glamorized for the sake of Hollywood and show business, if you will. How bang on would you say it was?
I think it may have been 85% correct. I think, like I said, I think what was missing out of there would have made the movie still, we'd still be watching it right now.
Right.
You know, and I understand, and one thing about it is being in entertainment so long, I understand Hollywood. I think what people want to see is something literal, because I think we all sit up and watch reality shows mm-hmm. all day, and we think that, you know, we could show that, you know, in a 2-hour time period. But
right.
I don't think that we could have showed every aspect, every angle, every, you know.
Yep.
Like I said, there mm-hmm. are some things that I would have wished were in the movie to make things a little more clearer for you. But overall, I think the message was given in a way to where it could have been given from the perspective of the people who were here. Like, for instance, Easy's perspective could never be given because he's not here. Even
there
if you ask me Easy's perspective, I'm not Easy. So
right.
I was with
right.
him until he died, but I'm not him. So it still wouldn't have been dead on, you know.
Got you.
So,
yep,
so
no,
that's, you know, that's what I do miss, but I'm glad that they paid homage, and a lot of people understand who Eazy-E is and now how he influenced all of these artists up to date, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
that was the importance of that movie. It really wasn't the intricate details of what happened mm-hmm. and what did. The importance of it was to say that N.W.A., Eazy-E and N.W.A. influenced people so high, to such a high volume, that look at music what it is today. Because when you look at it, and I look at a lot of these behind the musics and unsungs
yeah.
and all these, and a lot of people blame Eazy-E for the transition of music and them losing out when music changed over. It's like they changed the course of urban music. So
right.
when you have a group of people who changed the course of music, which I'm involved in that change,
yep.
I'm very proud of that.
I can see that. Yeah. I would be too. I mean, I would be too.
So when you make a movie about that, that is the objective. You know
yeah.
what I mean? It's not really the intricate details, because it would be very hard for us to do that, and that's why we're
sure.
all proud of that. Of course,
mm-hmm.
we know there should be things added in there. We know there should be things that, you know, that makes it brings a dead bang. But
yep.
in some cases, you don't have any control over that. So
sure.
But it needed to be done, my man. You know what I mean? It needed to be done.
Can you give me one thing, perhaps, just one thing you think maybe could have made it in that probably should have, or understand?
Well, I think the difference between Easy and
yep.
Dre was never shown, and they really had a difference, you know. Like, when they broke apart, it was more heartful, you know, hurtful on both sides. But I don't really think they showed how it affected Eric and how he fought back at him. You know what I mean? It kind of
right.
showed the Death Row side, but it didn't show when he left how he lashed back out.
I see.
The way
okay.
he defended himself, like, you know what I mean? Like that
yeah.
part is what was the part that I was like, that should have been in the movie. You
Understood.
Know, when he did real Compton City G's and how we made a series of records that really did really great. You know, when he
yeah.
left. I mean,
right.
we made a lot of, you know, we made a lot of, you know, we had a stable that was really solid, you know, when
yeah.
he left. It
right.
wasn't as bad as it was, and he wasn't so caught. He was a really strong businessman, you know.
Right.
That didn't defeat him, basically. You
right.
feel me?
Right, right, right.
And I
yep.
think that's
yep.
what, you know, what could have been in that. All the other stuff was, I think, was dead on, you know.
Sure,
so,
sure.
Because to me, if you're going to show how Cube lashed back, then you should have showed how Easy lashed back.
Yes.
You know.
Yep. That makes
you feel
sense.
Me? That was the part that really left a hole in it. But, you know, how they talk about Eric wanted everybody to get back together, yes, that he, you
yeah.
know, me and him had talks. He talked about that.
Yeah.
He told me exactly what they put in the movie. That's all
mm-hmm.
true.
Good.
He did want
Amazing.
That.
Good.
So everything you see up to this date that's happening, me and Dre being back together, me and Q being cool, all of us being on one level is what Easy wanted. He told me that
gotcha.
Out of his mouth. So,
right. Well, it's nice to see it.
But we have
nice
to me,
see, yeah.
to me, and another thing I think was crazy in there is is the way Doc was really an instrumental part, and he didn't have a really big part in the movie.
True.
And Rand didn't. But like I said, if we get into the intricate details, the movie would be long. But that's just me. That
right.
doesn't make the movie bad.
Exactly.
I think the movie's incredible.
No.
That doesn't make it bad. That's just because I was there, that's the way I feel.
And that's exactly it. You know details that people would have no idea to be able to conceptualize. So I get that loud and clear. I get that.
Right. That didn't make it bad. You know.
So, I hear you.
Because the overall story that was told was the right story.
It wasn't
a fabricated thing. It wasn't. You know.
Yeah.
It was dead on. Like I said, 85%. And it's just the fact that if you were there. If you were there at the exact story, I mean, if you weren't there at the exact story, if you were there, then, hey, you'd be like, okay, well, these 10 things happen, but those 10 things that play out will make the movie 5 hours, you know?
How much time you got? But, hey, I just want to see what's on the cutting room floor, man.
You know, when I talked to Laylaw, he said, man, the movie was really long at first, and he was like, it took him a bit to get it down to the 230 or 229 or 26 or whatever it is, you know. They shot every angle of it. I mean, and some stuff worked and some didn't work. But
right.
I think the actors did a really great job, and F. Gray did an incredible job, you know, on that film. I mean, I would knock it if you paid me to knock it.
Sure. No,
it was a great movie,
you.
Man.
You
know what I mean?
Well, going back to what you said, I think at the end of the day, when people walk away from that movie, it told the story that people had to hear.
Yeah.
I think that's the important thing. It did that. It accomplished its mission. And it made a lot of money for him, too. So awesome.
And for me, you know what was really great was that it was told from our perspective. It wasn't told from an outside hip-hop person that just took interviews. And, you know, sometimes you get these movies that they're outsiders, you know.
Right.
Everyone that was involved that is living were involved, which was great.
Yeah.
You know, like we have so many people tell our story, that when the story's finished, you'd be like, well, I was there and that didn't happen. Even people that's outside, like say, for instance, if you followed hip-hop from 1985 up to now, you'd be like, and someone told a story that just kind of like researched it and looked it up and they're, you know, and they weren't around. You'd be like, that didn't happen. This happened
right
here. That didn't just happen like this, you know. And we have so many people doing that. You know, they're so fascinated with an era and a time, and they tell a story, and it's like it didn't even go like that.
Gotcha.
You know? And that was a great thing about that we were able, you know, to tell that story from our perspective, as far as the people who were involved were able to tell their own story.
Amazing.
That's really
amazing.
A problem in hip-hop now. Because we have a lot of people, the outsiders, trying to tell our story, and they leave a lot of things out and a lot of people out, you know, out of the story because it's what they think, because they looked at the charts and they looked at this and they looked at who's popular and you know,
that's
who's
exactly
on
it.
This. And they don't really go and be like, okay, and this year, this what made this happen. And that year, this is what made this happen. This caused this chain reaction. This caused that. You know, they don't really know those things. They just know what's popular, and that's the story that they tell.
That's it. No, that's it. And then, of course, that becomes common knowledge to everyone, and that's the way it goes, and no one ever really knows the truth after that. So,
Yeah.
There you get it.
It's not us telling the story. It's outside people. It's not us.
Exactly.
You know, fortunately, we have, like, you know, like yourself, if you're doing old school outlets where people can get on and come on and tell you their story and tell you how it went down, you know, because a lot of us are still living, you know.
That's right.
So,
and that's why we do this, for that exact same reason, paying homage the right way, and that's really the way it should be. So, again, I appreciate you sharing all kind of great insights and about you and your career above the law. I mean, above the law, 25 years plus, it's got to be a blessing to be able to make music.
Absolutely.
Still talking about it. So, and congratulations. I know you're nowhere near done. You still got lots to do and lots to accomplish, but certainly I want to acknowledge that.
We got new music coming right now. You know, we got the men. Me and Laylaw, executive producing my solo album. It's called The Black Godfather. And then we got 25 Years of Hustling coming out. You know, rest in peace, my man KMG. Me and him did 26 songs, and me and DJ Chaos are going to put out two different albums. and then a book with 10 new songs on it next year. So yeah, we're constantly moving, man. You know, me and Cocaine is putting out the Architects of G-Funk album. That'll be coming out next year as well.
Oh my!
And, you know, we continue to
love
just keep pumping music, man. You know, because we love it.
I hear you.
We love y'all. You know,
we appreciate you so much. And again, Hutch, thanks for being on the program. To our listeners, let's get back to the music.
Yeah, yeah.
Old school, new school, and true school on Maximum FM Hip Hop.